An unassuming GMT 800 teaches me that brand loyalty is for the birds, just not the Jaybird anymore.
Oh, my song choice for this week has to be The Perfect Space by the Avett Brothers. I was really into them in this time period, but that song says it all. Everything about that time period. There's that line where he says, I want friends that will let me be when being alone is all that I need. Such a great song. So just imagine that right now and jump inside.
Welcome to the Wrecking Yard. I'm Jerry Wayne Longmire. If you hadn't seen the first episode, I always recommend going back and watching it, because then you'll kind of understand the nature of my format. If you have seen it, great. Glad you're here again. Always appreciate you guys sharing some of your Sunday with me to do this. Today we're going to talk about one of my favorite vehicles I've ever owned in my life, and the story about how that vehicle came into my life. Right here is normally where I would do the sponsorship. I still have not signed up with these sponsors yet, but we're still working on that. So this would be all the gratuitous Diamond Gem certified, Diamond Gem built, you know, what have you, that sort of thing. Today we're going to talk about a 2000 GMC Z71. And a couple things before we get it, let's do some comments and then we'll get off into this, because this bears a worthy discussion for a variety of reasons. We're going to talk a little bit about brand loyalty today, and I know some of you have heard me say some things about it, but I feel very strongly about it. But let's get into some comments from last week's episode. The Mazda 626, I saved them right here on my phone. Let's see. JW, I want you to... this is Metal Matt Gaming. JW, I want you to know that I've been struggling with the passing of my father and becoming a father in a six-month span. Jeez. But the Wrecking Yard has been helping me process the hurt of losing a dad and the fear of being a dad in a powerful way. I could write and babble and go on for a whole lot longer, but I'll leave it here. Keep doing what you're doing, boss. You're making a positive difference just by you doing you. Hey, thank you for that, Matt, and I cannot imagine losing my father and becoming a father all in that same time period. I did, I'm actually going to talk today about losing my mother a little bit. I lost my mother. My kids were very young, and she missed out on all kind of stuff that I really thought she was going to be here for, so I can certainly sympathize with that. And man, as far as the dad stuff goes, I mean, I got teenagers now. Just became teenagers, all of them. But the biggest part is showing up and try not to yell too much. You know, mow the yard. It's the big parts of it. Listen to them. You know, I've enjoyed being a father. It's been probably the most difficult job I've ever had in my life, but also the one I kept the longest. You know, I drug up on a lot of them. You can't drag up on kids. You can't get mad at lunch and be like, screw this. You know, you can. There's guys that do that, but that's not my way. Matt, I do hope things improve. I'm glad you're watching the show. And I think you're going to be fine. Just show up. Let's see what else we got. Tyler Young, 7650. My first motorcycle was a 77 Yamaha 750 triple. Working on that thing taught me how to wrench on bikes. 20 years later, still doing it. Still have that old triple somewhere. Boy, I wish I had my triple. I sold mine. Oh, man. I tore mine all down and, like, made a chopper out of it at one point. Just like a fun little rat chopper. And gave it this crazy... I'll have to find pictures of that paint job so y'all can see. I gave it this crazy wild... Before people were doing faux patina stuff, I did this wild paint job on this bike, on this Yamaha triple. Anyways, my buddy David was going to put like a 7-wire electrical system on it, like if you're building a Harley or something, you know, like a aftermarket bike. And it went and sat in his shop for like 3 years, and I forgot about it, and he forgot about it. And honestly, when I was getting ready to move back to Houston, he had somebody offer him some money for it, and I said, sell it, baby, let it ride. And but now I got this shop and everything over here. I kind of wish I still had it, you know, because it'd be a fun little bike to tinker on. I think I'm about to pick up a pair of Hondas, though, from my neighbor. So Y'all might be seeing them here in the future. Let's see. And Sean Barlow. Hell yeah, man. When you going to be close to Green? Oh, Green, Texas. Between Austin and San Antonio next. Would like to get my parents some ticket to your next show in that area. I don't have anything booked in that area, Bubba. There's not a lot going on out there comedy-wise. You know, everything's either in Austin or in San Antonio. I will be in Seguin, Texas, headlining the Palace Theater August 3rd. And I'm bringing my good buddy Barry Laminek. Some of y'all might have seen me on his show, Barry on Deck. He's a sports guy and everything for ESPN. But he's a good dude, and he's a funny comic. And Barry's going to come with me for that August 3rd show. Seguin, Texas, the Palace Theater. In fact, the owner of the Burnt Bean Barbecue Place reached out to me and asked me if they could, you know, if I'd come and they'd feed me and Barry. And because people was telling me about it, and I was like, yeah, it's cool, but I don't wait in lines for food. I just don't. I don't care how good your food is. I'm not getting in a line that goes around the building waiting on food. I'm just not doing it. I will just go eat somewhere else. I'm just that kind of person. I don't know why it gets under my skin so bad, but it does. I don't do it. I don't wait in lines for food. But he hit me up. He goes, you don't have to wait in a line. We're going to bring in here, which made me feel a little wormy, you know, because I don't like using my whatever you call this thing, this fucking whatever you call this thing, this pseudo internet half-ass fame or whatever. I don't like using it, you know. It's not like a thing, like I'm just not one of those people. It makes me feel kind of icky. But it turns out when it comes to barbecue, my morals are very slippery. I mean, we're talking the slickest. We're talking Pennzoil, babe. So my morals are like anti-seize. They're just silver and get all over you. That's stupid. All right, let's jump off into it. Boy, I confused myself. I'm just not quite awake yet. I'm going to tell y'all this just before we get into any of this about this truck, but up until this point in my life, I was a Ford man. All right, I preferred Ford over everything. I prefer Ford styling. I preferred Ford engines for working on. I preferred Ford trucks. And they had done me dirty. They had done me dirty. Considering the truck I'm driving at the beginning of this story is one of the worst blasted vehicles I've ever owned in my life. And it was a Ford. So they had done me dirty, but I was a Ford guy. I was a Mustang guy. I liked Fords. Thought Chevy sucked. I was one of those morons, you know. Walking around just thinking one company did it all right and one company did it all wrong. It's about as bad as politics, really, when you get down to it. And this truck changed that for me. This truck helped me open my eyes to understanding manufacturing a little bit better and understanding cars a little bit better. The GMT 800. General Motors spent like 15 years designing this truck. They went around, they were talking to mechanics, and the GMT 400 was always already a very successful series. And they wanted to blow it out of the water. They wanted to be, and honestly, the GMT 800s, in my opinion, are probably some of the most durable, solid, at the time, low expense, light duty work pickups that the United States has ever had on offer. They're pretty daggum good. They spent a long time designing them. They made them easy to work on. They made them compartmentalized. They were really cool. They came with, they had like three or four different frame sections. So these trucks, they could put them in just about any configuration just by swapping some frame sections out, which is pretty neat as far as a manufacturing aspect. I got the truck from my good friend Bob Clausen. He's more of a mentor. Bob Clausen is one of the biggest men I've known in my life. And not just in physical size, but in personality. Like just, he's just a huge man. He's 6'2", 6'1", with just a crushing hand grip. He had hands like steel claws, big old hands. And his personality is bigger than that, and his generosity dwarfs all that. He was a veteran, Air Force veteran. who's his shenanigans in the 50s put Sergeant Bilko to shame. I've heard all the stories from him, too. He had a mechanical engineering degree from University of Kansas. His father was a machinist for the Union Pacific Railroad. And Bob made most of his money working for Shell as a project manager and engineer in Libya in the 70s and 80s. Even raised his own family over there, his own kids over there. And even though he's from Kansas, his nickname was Big Tex, right? Because he's just this big old cowboy type. He's lived all over the world, and when I meet him, he's about 80, and even at 80 years old, he can still crush the soul out of your hand. He can command any room, and I'm, of course, fascinated with him. He's got stories for days, and he's just found an ear. The first, when I first met Bob, I was driving the truck I was talking about, the 91 Ford F-250, that turned out to be the bane of my existence. I bought it from a fellow in Baytown over in the evening one night, and if I ever see that guy again, it's a beating on sight. At the time when Bob meets me, I had put a rebuilt short block 351 in it, and I'd bought it from Precision Engines, and it only, at that time, it was only vapor locking about once or twice a day, so it was probably at its best of any of the time I owned it. I'd been working for a condo complex. I got this job right after Hurricane Ike, doing all the maintenance for a condominium complex up on Lake Conroe called April Point South. I did a lot at the time. I did a lot of side work at the time. You know how it is. And I spent most of my free time like woodworking, honestly. That was like my favorite hobby. I'm still doing just a little bit of stand-up, but honestly, since my kids have been born, I'm devoting way more time to my business. And I've got this dumb, crazy idea that I can make enough money to buy my freedom and go pursue comedy full time again. That's a pipe dream. That's a pipe dream. Don't do that. Don't spend your life waiting on things to be right. Prepare, yeah, but sure don't waste your youth waiting on everything to line up just right. Where is the dad blasted end of this tape? Oh, there it is. I wasted a lot of my time doing that. Well, like, well, I need to wait for this to be right to do this. And just don't do that. It's never going to be the right time. There's never going to be enough money. If you think about having kids or whatever, it's never going to be the right time. You're never going to feel right. You're never going to be ready. There's never going to be enough money. Don't frame your life like that, because you will find yourself wanting for some things you do not accomplish. And so just take it from me. Not the way to go, because I certainly did a lot of that, especially at this time period. For reference, it's probably, I think it's about 2012. No, let's say 2013. I don't know why I did. It is 2012. It's the back part of 2012. Definitely post-July, because I spent that summer rebuilding that engine, and we had just moved to Conroe, and my youngest is born in 2012. He's born in July in 2012. And I know he was born by the time I had this pickup, I think. Anyways, back to Bob. So first time I meet Bob, he's this big old fella, right? And the first time I meet Bob, I am driving through the property. I was there doing some work. I'm driving through the property, and it's like right before lunch, and I hear this big booming voice go, "Hey, Jimmy Jerry!" Right? And only because he had seen my name at one of the POA meetings. He knew I was the maintenance guy, but he couldn't remember it, so he called me Jimmy Jerry, and I, of course, slowed truck down, and So yeah, what can I do for you? He's a big old tall fella with an Australian flop hat, you know, the hat with the one wing up and the one down, you know. He's got one of those on, a big old leather Australian flop hat or suede or something like that. And he's got a University of Kansas old beat to death hoodie that I think maybe he's still wearing somewhere, but he's got this old beat to death Kansas, University of Kansas hoodie on, and sweatpants, tennis shoes, nothing to indicate the man's wealthy, nothing to indicate the man's stature or anything like that. Just good old boy, you know, just chilling out. And he's standing by a little tan GMC Yukon, very unassuming. Nothing fancy about it. These old condos, they were waterfront condos, right? And they're, you know, 2 and 3 bedroom waterfront condos right there on Lake Conroe. And he had a big old smile, like if James Spader was 80 and bigger. Just big old smile, you know? And I forgot what he asked me. He looked at me. I slowed the truck down. He said, "Jim and Jerry, you any good at setting toilets?" And boy, let me tell you, at the time, I used to make an extra $200-$300 a week stabbing toilets, you know, because most of those units, most of the homes around that part of the lake right there were built in the late 70s. So at this time I'm there, most of them been remodeled once, like sometime in the 90s, and now they're getting updated again. And people are buying them and updating them again. And also, fair to note, at this time, Lake Conroe is like one of the fastest growing home markets in the United States. It's going crazy. People are moving there, buying land left and right, building homes. It's actually kind of a nightmare because there's no regulation there and there was no permitting and nothing going on. And you had guys, I made a joke about it last week, but you had guys that were in the oil field their whole life, and the oil field laid them off, and they decided they was a home builder because their daddy knew how to build homes or some crap, you know, like they learned it through osmosis. But yeah, he walked up to me. He said, "You any good at setting toilets?" I said, "Yes, sir." And I shut the truck off, and I was dirty as hell, Bubba. Let me tell you, I had just sweat just dumping off me. I'd been pouring and shaping concrete curbs where the big trucks hit them with their tires and break them in the apartments. And he said, "How much do you charge?" I said, $75 a toilet, sir. He said, "I'll give you $100 a piece to come do 2 toilets, but you got to do them tonight before you leave here." And I said, "Boy, that's, you know, I ain't going to argue with that." I said, "But I don't get off work kind of late. It's going to be like 6 or 7 before I get done work, but usually stabbing a couple toilets, we're talking about an hour and a half, as long as the flange ain't broke and, you know, I don't run into a bunch of problems and such." So I told him, I said, "It's probably going to be after 6. He said, "That's fine, Jim and Jerry, just knock on my unit, you know, with that tan Yukon." I went and finished those curbs and stuff. I was wore slap out. This is summertime in Texas. I called Rach, let her know I picked up some side work, but she knew the deal, you know. It was feast or famine, so she was always, I would just let her know I was going to be late. When I showed up to Bob's house, he's sitting in a recliner watching the movie Patton. Bob's been watching Patton as long as I've known him. Every time I've gone in his house, that movie's on. I'm not sure he's ever finished it. I guess it's just his comfort flick. Anyway, he hops up, he's excited, he wants, you know, wants to talk to me, wants to know where I'm from, that kind of stuff. We just jawed while I took the old toilets out, and I cleaned up the floor and the flanges, and I took them old junk toilets out to that old F-250 and throwed them in the back, and it seems like there was always 2 or 3 toilets in the back of that truck. And turned around, "Bob, where's the new toilets?" He said, "Oh, Jim and Jerry, we got to go get them." He said, "I'll get my keys and my money bag." He kept all his money and his checks and his wallet and his IDs and stuff in a big old bank zip-up money bag. And he would carry it in that pouch pocket, that kangaroo pocket on that hoodie. I got to go call Rach again. I was like, "It's crazy old dude ain't even bought the toilets yet. So I got to go with him to Home Depot." So we and him load up in his car. We go to Home Depot. When I tell you he talked to everybody in Home Depot, I mean he talked to everybody in Home Depot. We got everybody's opinion on them toilets. before we got to the checkout. Okay, people are just trying to walk by, people trying to work and stock. Bob talks to everybody. He's one of the most affable men I've ever known. He can make conversation with absolutely anybody. And he does. He utilizes that ability. And we've been at Home Depot like an hour now getting these toilets. And over there in West Davis, off West Davis, right there off West Davis 45. Been there like an hour getting these stinking toilets. And we get ready to pay, and Bob pulls out his Air Force identification from the 50s so he can argue and get his military discount on these toilets. Oh, I love that old man. What should have been an hour and a half is like now turned into like a 6-hour job. I think it was like 11 o'clock when I got home from his house that night, but he stuck $300 cash in my pocket. And after that, we were friends. We were buddies. He'd see me out on the property. He'd come jack and jaw with me. And boy, I did so many jobs for him. I worked for him all the time. We would tell stories. We'd talk about the places we'd been. He'd been a lot more places than me. So it was really interesting to me. He would tell me stories about Libya and stories about his time in the Air Force when he was basically like a quartermaster or something in the Air Force in the 50s. And he had figured out that if he just told them he was out of everything all the time, they'd send him all new stuff and fill all his supplies up. And then he would take those things and go barter with the other branches and other people at other bases and stuff to get what he needed. It was funny. It was very Sergeant Bilko. I think he even ran an underground poker game at some point. he was a hoot. So anyways, I worked for him for a while. One night, he flew to Holland all the time. He'd been married to a woman in Holland at some point in his life, and she was like a purser for KLM. So he flew KLM all the time, the whole time he's living overseas. So it like there was like a hutch in one part of his condo unit. And I watched him buy a house cash one time just because the house was across the street from his ex-wife's house. And he said that he swore in front of God and his friends and everybody he'd take care of that woman the rest of his life till death do him part. And even if they weren't married anymore, he had a responsibility. So he bought the house across the street from her just so he'd keep an eye on her when she was having some health problems and stuff. And they had a couple kids. They had three kids. They had a daughter and two sons. And I didn't know the daughter and the son that well. I mean, I met them a couple times, hung out with the daughter and the oldest son a couple times. They're very nice people. His youngest son, Jeff Clausen, I got along with really well. I mean, we sort of messed with each other, give each other business back and forth. But Jeff was probably in his 50s at the time. And he was a pretty good dude. Plus, he lived in the neighborhood and he took care of his mom and dad. So I always liked that about him. He had a son named Chris, which is where my truck came from. By this time, I've done lots of jobs for me and Bob do work together all the time. He's had me paint some of his houses. We put a he had this big table that he bought from the Taj Mahal, and this table was made with all these amazing gems and stonework and everything, and it was translucent. You hold a light up to the bottom of it and the light would show through the gems and the rose petals and stuff, and it was all floral. It was really beautiful. And he literally was at the Taj Mahal visiting, saw this table hanging on a wall built by one of the artists, and bought it. Bob was very, very wealthy. You could not tell by looking at him or even talking to him. But he was a man of means. He had done very well for himself in his life. And he had a great appreciation for art and entertaining and things like that. He loved the fact that I was into comedy. And I wasn't doing a lot of comedy at this point. Still doing a few road gigs here and there. But after everything that happened with the Laugh Stop, I got a bad taste in my mouth. And I'm trying to feed some kids, you know, and keep a happy home. So that requires a lot of money sometimes. One time Bob bought I would tackle any job he wanted to do. So one of my jobs became, as he moved between his different houses over the years, I would move that Taj Mahal table. And it had a big old marble base. And I don't know what that thing probably weighed about 600 pounds. And the table probably weighed 500 on its own. It was huge. It was a massive table. And it was always my job to pack it, prep it, and find a way logistically to move it. We moved that thing on landscaping trailers. Every time it took about 7 or 8 guys, I would wrap it in cardboard so we could roll it. It was the wildest thing, man. I moved that table all over freaking Conroe, it feels like. They had glass front doors facing the lake on the back of those units, big sliding doors. And these were built in the 70s, so they're like 9 foot tall. And I don't know, do they make a 90-inch sliding door? I don't remember. It was a huge sliding door. And we go to buy one. We had to custom order it to replace it. He wanted to replace it, get a brand new one. His was in real bad shape. And I just told him I could do it, you know. And I gave him a price. This is what I'm going to charge you to put it in and everything. And didn't even factor that I'd never messed with a door this big in my life. You do that sometimes if you're a contractor. You bite off more than you can chew. Just, hell, I got it. You know, you need that money. I'm going to figure out how to do it. When that thing showed up at the property, I realized that me and my helper weren't going to be able to move that door, you know. So I had to cut the old door out, and then Bob paid the landscaping crew, there's about 7 of them, $100 a piece to stay after work and help us pull the old door out and get it in the back of my dump trailer and get the new door and slide it around there and get it in place so that I could tack everything up and start getting it installed. But it took all 10 of us to move that freaking door and get it into position. Yeah, and that's pretty much what I'm doing. I'm working a lot of hours. Something I neglected to tell you guys in the Mazda story. No, I mean, we'll get back. This actually goes back to my Ford F-150, so we'll tell it in that story. But just to give you a precursor, sometime around 2001, 2002, it was right after I got rid of the Datsun. Sometime after that, I tore my back up really bad at work. I had a 500-pound Cobalt camera. There was a strap on it, and the strap broke, and it rolled down a trailer over me backwards and bit my back, like, in a way that shouldn't have done without breaking, and ended up tearing 2 discs, my L1, S1, which they still give me grief. And man, if y'all never listen to anything I say, listen to this right now, especially if you're younger. Do not let anybody break you and not pay you. Don't let them break your body and not pay you because you're worried about keeping your job or whatever. Workman's comp, they are not there for you. That's not what it exists for. It exists for that company. Do not let anybody break your body and not pay for it. There's a million other jobs you can get. There's a million other things you can do with your life. Don't let them break your body and not pay you for it. Because I let the oil field break my body and not pay me for it. And I let Metco Industries break my body and not pay for it. And here I am, 47 years old, you know, 20-something odd years later. And some mornings I can hardly get out of bed because of this injury I received. And at the time back then when I went to Workman's Comp, all they did was put me on hydrocodone. Now, I didn't look at taking pain pills every day like it was a drug, like I was partying. I wasn't partying on it or anything. But since that time period, I've been taking 4 pain pills a day because that's what the doctors prescribed to me. No problem back then. They just gave them to me left and right like candy. And I took those pain pills. I didn't party on them. I didn't go get drunk. In fact, at this point, I don't even drink at this point. I had quit drinking altogether. But I took those pain pills every day. I thought I needed them. And the problem with those pain pills is, while they did make the pain go away, they masked the pain so that constantly everything I was doing was re-damaging my back and got it in really bad shape. So the pain pills are dangerous, but I'm taking them every day just to kind of give you a heads up of where I'm at this point. And that Ford truck, oh, I can't wait to tell y'all about that nightmare. That F-250, it was a 91 F-250 with a 351 Windsor and a 5-speed. And I thought I wanted that truck more than anything in the world. And Whoo, God, I still remember the day I sold it. One of the happiest days of my life. But I had put, me and my dad had taken, I went and got a short block and put the short block back together and everything and had replaced that in the truck because I had popped the top off a piston in it. And one day I'm on my way, I'm painting Bob's house, and I got two painters working for me, and we're doing Bob's house, but we're doing it to the nines. This is not your $1,500 paint job. This is a $6,000 paint job, and I guarantee you most of that's being spent on painting supplies, because this house is going to look fine when we're done. And these two painters I had working for me, these two brothers, Mike and Mark, and about once a week they beat the piss out of each other on the job, and that was all right, because after that, they'd be fine. They'd go back to work. But about once a week, they'd lose it with each other and beat the piss out of each other on the job site. One time, we were spraying an apartment complex. We were doing the staircases at each end of like a 8-floor apartment complex. And there are these open staircases, metal staircases at each end, like fire escapes. And we're spraying lacquer. So me and my helper, we're at one end of the apartment complex, and we're spraying lacquer, and we're going to work our way down those stairs, right? And then at the other end is Mike and Mark, and they're going to work their way down their stairs. Well, we start spraying this lacquer. Buddy, I don't care how much respiratory stuff you got going on, how many masks you got. Lacquer's lacquer, baby, and lacquer don't play games. By the time I get down to the fifth floor, I'm high as an Eagles pecker, okay? I am soaring from them lacquer fumes. And we're just blowing and going. We're just spraying and going because we know we got to get it done. We want it to set. And we're just rocking and rolling. And I get down to about the third or the second floor, and I hear somebody hollering at me. And I turn around, and it's the guy that is kind of like our liaison for this apartment complex. And he's going, I don't know what's going down at the other end of the building, but your guys just got in a fight. And it's bad. You got to come down here. And I was like, oh, my God, what are these two idiots doing now? So I have to tell my helper, keep everything going. Just spray the rest of these steps. I'm going to run down here and see what's going on with them. Run down there. I got paint hood on, all that stuff. I go down there. They're both back painting like nothing happened. But I look at Mark, and Mark, the whole side of his face is swole up and bruised up. And Mike, the whole side of his mouth is all jawed up and swollen up, but they're cutting up and laughing. Apparently what happened, these two got mad at each other, got high on lacquer fumes, and started arguing and fussing on about the fifth floor. And when they got down to the third floor, Mark took a swing at Mike, and Mike popped him back, and Mark popped him back, and then Mike pushed Mark off the balcony, three floors, onto the ground. He flipped off the railing, went all the way down, landed on his back on the grass, sucked it up, got back up there, and got back to painting. These two guys were nuts, man. They worked for me for a little while around this time period. They're painting Bob's house. I've been running around doing errands, picking up some supplies. I'm on the way back to Bob's house, and that F-250, lo and behold, just starts blowing water outside the block, just like it's free, you know, just overheating. I get out of there. I can tell water's coming out the side of the block. I can't tell where. I'm on the side of the road, frustrated. And I have to have, I call and have Mike or Mark, one of the two of them had a car, come pick me up and bring me over to Bob's house so I could help him with the painting. And Bob's there, like always, watching Patton. Bob's, what's going on with your truck, Jimmy Jerry? He called me Jimmy Jerry the entire time he knew me, even after he knew my name. Because we just laughed. It was just a funny thing between us. It was Jimmy Bob, Jim Bob, Jerry, Jimmy Jerry, that kind of thing. He said, what's wrong with the truck, Jimmy Jerry? So I tell him, and he's like, man, you just put an engine in it, and you've done all this stuff. And he said, I tell you what. He said, my grandson just got a new car, and I got his pickup sitting out there right now. He said, that little champagne tan-looking, I forgot what the actual color is called. It was like silver. That little silver GMC out there. He said, why don't you take the keys to this GMC and just drive that home tonight, and you can just use it while you're doing this job until I figure out what I'm going to do with this pickup. And I said, well, I don't really feel comfortable driving your truck, Bob, but kind of in a rock and a hard place, and if you don't mind, yeah, I'll drive the truck. And I only lived about 6 minutes from property at the time. I lived right off 105 at the time in a little neighborhood called, doesn't matter. Anyways, LaSalle Oaks, maybe, something like that. They changed the name of it. But anyways, I lived right there, right by Vern's Country Catfish. So I drove that truck home. That truck was a 2000 GMC Z71 package Sierra half ton. Had a 5.3 liter 4L60 transmission. I know everybody's freaking out. I don't feel the way about 4L60s. Everybody else does. And we'll talk a little bit about that. But it's just a little four-wheel drive pickup. Never had a push-button four-wheel drive before. Never messed with any of that. But boy, it's just about, I've never had, so the newest vehicle I've owned up to this point has been like a 94 Ford F-150. And mostly I've just had old beaters and $1,000 trucks that I could buy and get running so I could use them and beat them to death for work. But this truck is nice, man. It's got leather seats. It's got that little warmer thing to warm up your butt. And it's just clean. It's clean as a whistle, you know. Now, a young person has owned it, so it's got some quirks, you know, because he was a little rough on it. But it's only got about 60, 70,000 miles at the time when I get it. And when I get done with this truck, it has 388,000 miles on it. Let me tell you, Jack, when I say I work this truck, I work this truck. So I drove it home that night. Rachel's like, why did he have you drive it? I could have come and picked you up. And I said, I don't know. He just wanted me to drive it home. He said I could use it while we're doing the job. I guess he's getting ready to sell it or something. And I'm focused on trying to figure out what to do about my truck. But I can't help but wonder what a pickup like this might cost to own. Because I'm a little tired of rowing gears in that big F-250. And I'm a little tired of being bounced around. And I like something a little more comfortable, maybe a little air conditioned. So I couldn't help that night but get on my various resources and try to figure out what that truck was worth. And at the time period, that truck was worth, they were going for about $6,500, $7,000 with those kind of miles on. So completely out of my price range, right? That's not going to happen. I can't afford that. So I pushed that thought out of my mind and start focusing on what to do about my Ford. I get my Ford, we go and we hook it up to a chain, and my buddy Terry Smart Jr. helps me pull my Ford home and get it in the driveway. And found out it's got a freeze plug that out of a short block I bought rebuilt, the freeze plug is already rusted in a short block that's 3 months old. When I tell you that truck hated me, that truck hated me. Yeah, so I get it back over there, and I go back the next morning to go work on Bob's house. And I walk in and I tell Bob, hey, I think I found out what's wrong with my truck. But I'm going to have to take a day off so I can go fix it. So we're going to put the job on hold so I can go get the truck fixed. And then, you know, I'll be back over here to finish the paintwork. Bob says, why don't you just keep driving that GMC? And I said, Bob, I, you know, it's a nice pickup, but I know you're getting ready to sell it, and I'd hate for it to get messed up here on the job site. And it's not something I can afford to buy. So, you know, I don't want to get too comfortable in it. And Bob told me, I'll never forget this. He throwed the keys back at me. He goes, Jerry, take the damn keys and learn how to recognize when somebody's trying to help you. And I'm like, what the hell? I don't even know what that means. My head's swimming. I got other work I got to go do, so I go do the other work. Come back and see Bob that evening. I was like, we really got to talk about, I mean, what are we doing here? And Bob goes, well, what do you think that truck's worth? And I said, I'm going to be honest. I looked it up. He said, I said, that truck's, you know, easy. Get you about $6,500, $7,000 right now. I said, easy. You get $7,000 for that pickup. It's clean. It's perfect. It's fully loaded. It's just perfect little pickup. It's got that extended cab with the suicide doors that open up backwards. I forgot what they call that. The best way anybody's ever done four doors on a truck, though. I love that. I hate big old four-door crew cab mom mobiles, but this thing is perfect. I love it. and bomb. And I'm a Ford guy. You know, I'm not a General Motors guy. I'm not a Chevrolet guy. I've never had any desire to own a Chevrolet in many years at this point. I just don't, I'm not into it. I don't like their styling as much, but I like this little GMC. It was a good looking little pickup. It was so clean, you know. And Bob said, what'd you find out it was worth? I said, $7,000, you know, easy. You can get $7,000 for that truck all day long. And Bob said, all right, let's call it $3,500. So he's going to give me the truck for half price. But even at $3,500, it's just not something I can swing right now. And I tell Bob that. I go, Bob, you know, truck's worth way more than $3,500, but also, I don't have $3,500 to give you for the truck. And Bob says, well, we'll do this. How much do you have to put down on a pickup right now? I said, well, I got about $1,200 free and clear right now. And Bob says, okay, give me the $1,200 and you can work the rest off. And I'll give you plenty of jobs to do so that you can do that. And I, of course, said, yeah, because that was a better deal than anybody else was going to give me, you know. And I did, man. I worked for that man night and day. I put insulation in his attic. I did everything he wanted to do, every crazy project he'd dream up. I moved that stinking Taj Mahal table about 4 foot. I put carpet in an upstairs bedroom for him and restretched it. I did every job Bob needed at the time, and also doing my full-time job during the day. But boy, did that truck make things easier. Especially, I told you, I had that jacked up back, and even in the summertime, I'd turn that little seat warmer on, and it would heat that spot in my back that was jacked up and make me a little looser, you know? Oh, that was a good little pickup. Never got stuck on me ever one time. And had some things. Now, when I got it, Chris had been pretty rough on that truck. It kind of pulled to the left, and I got under it right after I got it. Realized he had bent two of the shock. He had bent the shock mount in the back. I suspect he launched it off a curb or something, and it had a little damage to one of the ball joints. So I think I just replaced the whole control arm and everything on that side. And I aligned that one myself. We were talking about the tape measure trick and all that. And basically I called my dad and he kind of talked me through how to do it. And I aligned that truck myself and did pretty good. Didn't eat up no tires. Boy, and it sounded good. It had dual exhaust on it. And that little 5.3, that's about as good an engine as General Motors has ever made, I think. Because that little engine just hummed and run like a sewing machine. No problems, man. The worst that truck would do to me was about every 2 years that truck needed a water pump and sometimes one time a radiator. But it'd eat up a water pump, I don't know, every 30, 40,000 miles it felt like, 50,000 miles. And I rebuilt the front end completely on it one time. But that's because I was pulling a trailer with it, and when I would go around curves, the truck would like jump a lane, and we couldn't figure out what was going on. And I got up under the front end and realized I had a bunch of play in it, so I decided to rebuild the whole front end of that truck one time. And I think it only cost me about $200-something, hubs and control arms and all that stuff. I mean, it was just cheap to buy parts for. Like I said, General Motors had spent time making that truck easy to work on. They're known for that. You could access everything really easily. Anyways, I had those hub setups in the front. And I remember I spent about 4 hours trying to get that hub off on the driver's side. When I got to the passenger side, took the wheel off, started messing with the hub fell off. And that's why I was jumping lanes, because that hub was just getting ready to give up the ghost. Miracle I didn't have a wreck in it. Sorry, I'm trying to get this just right. I want that. Oh, that's pretty. It's a good truck, though. I did do some work on it in the time I owned it, but I was rough on it. I was hard on it. I put a lot of miles on it. And any of you have ever done contracting and construction work knows trucks, there ain't nothing takes a beating like a contractor's truck. And that one was no exception. But it's kind of a good time. Now there's a couple things going on. You know, we got two kids, we got babies. Noah's just born. He's a little bitty. And me and my mom are kind of, we're fussing a little bit, but we've straightened it up. But my mom had some control issues. I love her, but she did. And she was also very good at pushing my buttons. And so we were fussing about some stuff. And but we're working through it all, you know. And that little truck's there for all of it, you know. It's I like that little truck because at the time I could get two kid seats in the back seat of it, and I could take my whole family in that little pickup, and we would go to Midland. We did all kind of trips in that little truck. It was just our little family get around machine. Sorry. Let me get a little more off. There we go, baby. That's gonna look slick. Let that sit for a little bit. Keep this stirring so it's still workable, hopefully. It's got a pretty long work time on it. This little pickup at the time is the lifeblood, you know. It's doing all the work. It's keeping money coming in the household. I'm working hand over fist. I've got my main property contract. I've got, I'm doing all kinds of side work. I've started doing concrete jobs for people on the side. I've gotten really interested in structural repair, old buildings, foundation repair, stuff like that. Because I found a way to put some of my former knowledge and education to use in a way that suited me. And we were getting, Thanksgiving's coming up, and we're getting ready to, we're all going to go to my mom's house and have, my mom's going to throw like a big old family Thanksgiving. And she's tickled to death about it. She's excited. And she calls me the week before Thanksgiving. And she says, when you have your Crohn's issues, does it cause a lot of stomach pain? And I was like, yeah, that's, you know, that's the bulk of it. And she said, does it feel like this? And she's describing the stomach, this intestinal stomach pain she's having. And I said, I don't know, Mama. That sounds kind of serious. I think I'd go to the doctor. It doesn't sound like what happens to me. And she goes, well, I'll worry about everything. She goes, no, Mom, just run over your doctor, get checked out. You know, y'all got money, you got good doctors. Go use it. Thanksgiving's going to be fine. But she's all in a fuss about making Thanksgiving perfect. And she wants, she knows I like pumpkin pie and sweet potato pie. And she's won't do all that. And she also knows that Thanksgiving's my favorite holiday. That's my favorite time of year. It's my favorite time. It's just so many great Thanksgivings growing up with my family and eating off paper plates and hunting, hanging out with my cousins. And so she knows that's my one. She wants it to be big. And her grandbaby's going to be in her house for their first big Thanksgiving with her. And it's just it's an exciting time. But she called me and she worried me, and I went on back to work. I don't even know if I said anything to Rachel about it. And then I think maybe it's the day before Thanksgiving. My dad can't wake my mom up. He tries to wake her up, He can't get her to wake. She's like out of it. And he calls an ambulance and they take her to the hospital and inform us that her liver is failing. And my mom was an overweight person most of my life. She had a lot of demons she was working through, and she had some pretty bad stuff happen to her when she was a kid. And she's a big lady. And hospitals and medicine do not care about overweight people. They'll blame everything on your weight. I've experienced it. And they don't fight as hard for you. And she went in there and she had this liver problem. And the doctors, I remember the doctors were trying to tell us, oh, it's going to be all right. We just got to get this liver problem under control and stuff. But I told y'all, I'm a bookworm. I'm a reader. And I went home that night and I read everything about what had just happened to my mom. And that kind of thing doesn't happen until your liver's like done. It happens at the end. I knew this was serious. And the doctors kept trying to, and my dad, and they, you know, my dad and my sister lived with my parents at the time, and they lived down in Richmond, Texas, which was, you know, several hours away from where I lived at the time in Conroe, so I didn't get to get over there as much as I'd like to, and I worked all the time. You know how it is when you're young, you got kids, you work all the damn time. And everybody, oh, I'm going to start my own business, so I don't have to work. So, no, you're going to work five times as much if you start your own business. There ain't no more holidays. You don't ever take time off when you have your own business because there's always a check you're trying to get. There's always something you're trying to do. So I guess my neighbor is throwing a rave at 8 o'clock in the morning. That's cool. Anyways, so she's sick, and I know she's sick, and I know it's worse than they're letting on to us. And it just progressively starts to get worse and worse. And at some point, she gets cellulitis, and it just gets worse. You know, when somebody's in the hospital for a while, and Thanksgiving goes by, and we're hoping, you know, they're trying to get her out for Christmas, you know, and I got all these big plans about the best Christmas I'm going to give my mom, and what a great son I'm going to be when she's home for Christmas, and I was practicing to learn how to sing one of her favorite songs, The Lion Sleeps Tonight, and Sherry by Frankie Valli, because she loved 50s and 60s rock. And she used to listen to 94.5 all the time. That used to be an oldie station. It's like an alternative rock station now, or who knows what it is now. But that used to be the oldie station in Houston. That's what she liked. And probably the reason I love all that music, too. And Christmas comes and she's not getting better. We go up and have Christmas with her in her hospital room. And I'm driving at nights. You know, I'm working full time, working 10, 12 hours a day. But then at night I get off and I would drive down to the hospital to see her in Sugar Land, Texas, about 2 hours. And I would get to see her for a little bit, and then I would come home, and I mean, I'd always get stuck in traffic on this overpass from Beltway 8 to 45 to get back on 45 North. This is before they built Highway 99. So I'd have to take Beltway 8 around, get on 45 North to come back to my house in Conroe. And two things, when you got kids that little, you don't want them to know. I didn't want Junie's a kid, man. She's just a toddler. I don't want to come in this house with the way I'm feeling, because that just scares kids. They don't understand, you know, and they're too young to understand something's happening to grandma, or we call her nanny. Something's happening to nanny. So I got to plaster a smile on my face every time I walk in that door and pretend like everything's okay. And everything is the most un-okay it's ever been in my life. I would get stuck on that overpass for, it seemed like 45 minutes every night, trying to get on 45 North. And I would be in there listening to my 50s and 60s rock and screaming and raging at my God and threatening. I was never going to believe in anything again. I was just going to be the sorriest son of a bitch that ever existed if you didn't stop this. And then some nights I'm pleading and I'm begging and bartering, and I'll get back in church. I'll do all these things you want me to do, but it just doesn't work like that. But it's hard to see that sometimes when you're going through something. And I'm going through it, man. And then I get in the driveway, and I have to sit there and steel myself and dry my face up so I can walk in that house and look at those babies and let them know that everything's okay in the world, because that's my whole job for them. I remember the movie Brave. It's a little Disney movie about a little redheaded bow and arrow girl in Scotland or Ireland or something, and she don't get along with her mom, and it's a whole thing. You should check it out. My kids loved it. We watched it a lot. Junie, my oldest, is just hung up on that movie. We just got it on Blu-ray, watching it. You know how kids are, just watching it nonstop. So every time I come in the house, that movie Brave is playing. And I usually just go sit on the couch by Rachel, and she'll rub my back because she knows what's going on. And I'll keep it together for the kiddos. We'll watch a movie. In fact, there's a song for that movie Brave called Into the Open Air. And I can't hear four notes of that song without just bawling these days, you know, because it just takes me right back to that feeling. Then we'd put the kids to bed, and I'd read them. My mom had got my kids these books, and they were all a John Denver song. Every book was a John Denver song, and it had a cassette or a CD that you played with it, and you sang the book to them. And we had Sunshine on Your Shoulders, and Take Me Home Country Roads, and the one about the dolphins and the ocean. Excuse me. And we'd put the kids to bed, and then we'd go to our room, and I would fall apart and then try to sleep and then get up and go do it all again the next day. And I didn't go visit her every night, but I went quite a bit. And it just gets worse. It just gets worse. There's a period sometime in the beginning of December where I'm having all these feelings about what's happening to my mom and our liver failure. And I know that's a danger with the hydrocodone because I've read too many stories about it. And I decided that I don't want to take these pills anymore. I've been taking these pills nearly 10 years at this point. And I don't want to take them anymore. I don't want to live like that, and I don't want my kids to have to say goodbye to me when I'm 56 years old, you know. And God, if something don't get me, but I know those pills are going to get me if I don't get off of them. And I quit them cold turkey. And when I tell you that's the hardest thing, I did it December 6th of 2012. I know the exact date. I poured them all down the disposal and flushed them. And it was all because of a conversation I had with another comedian. And you guys know him. He's huge now. But I knew him way back when. We did some gigs together and stuff. And his name is Rodney Norman. Rodney Norman is an incredible human being. He's one of the best I've ever known. And Rodney told me one time, Rodney was a Marine. And I said, what made you become a Marine? And he said, well, he said, I needed a job. He said, but more importantly, his kid had passed. His kid had died. And he said, I realized that they weren't going to be able to do anything to me in boot camp that was going to hurt me worse than what I was already going through. And that stuck with me. And I was going through that stuff with those pills, and I didn't want to take those pills anymore. And they were also making them harder to get. You know, everybody was cracking down on them, and so I throwed them out cold turkey without thinking that through. Shouldn't do that with opiates. Definitely should wean yourself off, especially them good government opiates. My God. When I tell you, for 30 days, I didn't want to get out of bed. I mean, I did, but I didn't want, like, my eyelids hurt. Everything hurt when I stopped taking those pills. And I had this little cash doctor that I've been going to see, Dr. Andy. He's a great doc. And Dr. Andy prescribed me some Tramadol to help, like, wean myself off those pills, but like a week or 2 weeks worth, because those are also habit forming too, so you gotta be careful with them. And I got off the pills, which is great, and they didn't hurt. They hurt, but they couldn't hurt any worse than what was happening. My mom was dying, and I knew it, and I felt like I was the only person that knew it, because everybody else was trying to be hopeful and tell me, and the doctors were just lying to us every time we went in there. Now she's in a rehab hospital. She's in a, you know, where they send people who aren't getting better. She's in this place called Kindred Care or something over in Sugar Land. Horrible, ratty place. And she's not coherent all the time, because sometimes I tell a story about it on stage, but when your ammonia levels get out of whack, it can cause psychosis and stuff. And one of the worst days of my life, I walked in that hospital room. My mom thought I was her little brother, because me and Uncle Bobby were very similar looking. In fact, the older I get, the more I look just like him. in ways. And she said a lot of awful stuff she was mad at her brother about to me, and I just had to take it because I knew she didn't know who she was talking to. It's a hard time. You know, some people know their family members, some people don't, but my mom was my best friend. I loved her. And they brought her home at some point for hospice care, and she just wanted to be at home. So they brought her to her and my dad's house and set up hospice care, and my aunts were there. And one night, sometime in the beginning of January, Rachel's father, who's out in Midland, Texas at the time, has a heart attack. And we have to pack the babies up in that little Chevrolet, the GMC pickup, and we haul ass out to Midland, we check on her dad, and we get him through all that. And she's like, "But your mom's at home in hospice care, we should get back." And I said, "Well, she's in a coma. She's not really talking or anything, so..." We're getting ready to leave Midland in the morning. My dad calls me. He said, "Your mom's come out of a coma. She's talking. She's asking for you. And, you know, I know you guys are out in West Texas, but if you can get here, I know she'd love to see you." And boy, when I tell you, I put the hammer down on that GMC. We made that trip from Midland to Conroe in about 7 hours or something. I don't know, man. We drove straight on to my parents' house in Richmond. And we took the babies, we had pictures. My mom's skin was all yellow. She didn't look normal. And she kept getting on to me all day because I'd look at her and I guess I looked sad. And she's like, "Why are you looking at me like that? Do I look this bad?" And I was like, "No, it's just because I had already the night before read about something called a rally." What happens a lot of times is right before patients pass on, they rally. And they feel real great for a little while. And everything looks super hopeful and amazing. And I knew she was rallying. She was rallying. I knew it the whole day I was there. I knew this wasn't real. We spent the whole day over there. And I went home. And I, of course, had to go back to work immediately because I'd taken days off for Rachel's dad's heart attack. And I was behind on work. And I think the next night she slipped back into a coma. And it's the next night or a night or two after she slipped back into a coma. And I would call over there and I would check on her. And they'd tell me what was going on. But, you know, it wasn't a whole lot. And one morning, I was on my way to get materials. that pickup truck. And I had this feeling of like all this weight just lifted off of me all of a sudden. Just all of a sudden it felt like I could breathe again. Like I hadn't been able to breathe in a month or two. And I pulled in the Home Depot parking lot right there on West Davis. And it was about 9 o'clock in the morning and I called my parents' house. And my sister answered the phone and I heard my sister ask my dad, "Can I tell him?" And I knew. And she tells me, she says, she passed away about 15, 20 minutes ago. Oh, I sat in that truck. I called my wife. Rachel said, "I don't care what you got going on. I don't care what jobs are happening. Just come home." And then I called my brother. I know I've talked about him a little bit, but outside of Rachel, Joey is my best friend in the entire world. Joey is one of the most important people to me in my world. We have been through up and down together. And at this time, we are kind of having a falling out. We haven't been speaking much. But one of the things my mom told me when she was in the hospital, she said, "Do not let your friendship with Joey go unrepaired. I don't care what you got to do to fix that. You're going to need him for the rest of your life. Do not let that friendship go by the wayside." And so I called Joey. I said, "I know you've asked about my mom. She's part of our family. And she passed away this morning. And Joey cried a little. And I said, I got to go home, be with Rach, but I'll talk to you soon. And I drove home. I don't remember driving home. I remember pulling up in the driveway and just sitting in that truck for a long time, the radio going. I was listening to the Avett Brothers. I was real big into them at the time. And Rachel came outside and got me out of the truck and walked me in the house. I was crushed. I was completely... I knew it was coming. You know it's coming. But people say that dumb crap. You can know it's coming for 10 years. It doesn't matter. When it gets there, it's there. And there's no amount of arguing or arguing with your maker that's going to change it. It's just something that's already happened. And of course, I have to call. I've got a big concrete job going at the time. And I've got to put that on pause. And that's costing me money and everything. Because we got to go up to Kilgore. And we got to bury my mom. And one of the things I got resentful about with my dad, and it wasn't his fault, but I blamed him. And that's completely unfair. But I was just angry at everybody. And I was so angry at him for letting her get this bad without realizing how serious it was. Not that he could have done anything about it. And it's not fair to blame him, but I did. I was so angry at him. I was so angry. And then also, him and my sister did most of the stuff. My dad used to say, he's emotional like his mom. And, you know, sister's more like me. And they did all the, you know, I didn't really get a say in anything. You know, they did all the funeral arrangements and all that stuff. And I didn't get asked about anything. I'm also struggling at the time because my grandmother acted pretty horribly after my mom died. Her own daughter died, and she was too busy stealing things out of my dad's house and stealing my mom's belongings, you know, to deal with any of that. And I know she did that. She got caught red-handed. She stole a Christmas gift that we gave my mom in the hospital that was still in the package. It was this little jewelry tree thing, you know. It was just pretty little pretty thing. My mom liked little pretty things. She collected salt and pepper shakers all her life. And, you know, they never had money. When they finally got money, she liked fancy things. And she got herself some fancy things. And here Granny was, you know, the coroner don't even have my mom's body out of the house. And Granny's loading up her car, stealing my mom's crap. That woman. So struggling. So we load up the kids and we go to Kilgore. And no, that did not work out the way I planned it to. And we get up there. Of course, all the arrangements have been made. And we're staying in a hotel room. And my mother-in-law drove up to Kilgore. At the time, my mother-in-law lived in Midland. And she dropped everything she was doing, and she drove to Kilgore so that she could watch the kids for us during the funeral. And, you know, we just didn't have to worry. It was one less thing to worry about. And the kids, they were too young. They need to go to a, you know, daggum funeral at that stage in their life. And the funeral's a trip because my mom's family are hillbillies. Love, you know, they're junkyard people. My mom's sister showed up to the funeral drunker and cooter brown, you know, but grieve how you need to, you know. That's how what I think. But it was funny. My other aunt showed up. My dad accused my other aunt of being stoned, but I was the one that I was stoned out of my gourd. I had to speak at my mother's funeral, and I'll never forget. I had found this Dr. Seuss quote and wrote this whole speech based off his Dr. Seuss quote. And I had shared this Dr. Seuss quote with my sister. And my sister, God love her, got up to do her eulogy in front of me and did her whole eulogy about that Dr. Seuss quote. I remember I was sitting in the pew by my wife, squeezed her hand like, Kimberly's up there stealing my damn act. You know, I got to go on stage here in 5 minutes. She stole my act. Rachel's like, this is not a show. And I was like, everything's a show. You don't understand how this works. And I was right, because I got 3 applause breaks in my mom's eulogy, and I sent her off in style. I said some wonderful things about her, and I made the people cry, and I made people laugh. It's what I do. I'm very good at it. But I was stoned out of my gourd the entire time because I could not deal with that head first and sober. And I was actually using a lot of weed at the time because I was coming off in pills. I was in so much pain, you know, everything hurt. And the thing about coming off those pain pills was, yeah, okay, I'm not on the pain pills anymore, but my back's still jacked up. Now it's worse because I've been eating pain pills and digging trenches and building 100-foot of boardwalk in a day and doing all kind of crazy stuff that you do when you feel like you're Superman and young. And so now my back's really jacked up, so I'm in a lot of pain the whole time. That truck did the hard jobs. The truck drove in her funeral procession to where we laid her body to rest in Danville Cemetery. And we came home from the funeral, and I had to immediately bury myself back in work again because I was so behind now. And honestly, I kind of went on autopilot for a little while. Right after we get back from the funeral, I blew the rear end out in that truck while we were at the funeral, I think. Because it got to, something happened. I'd been pulling a bunch of trailers with it and stuff, and I was rough on it. I'd overload it, everything. I treated it like it was a Ford Ranger. And I would turn the corner, and the inside wheel would start trying to go back, beep, 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 backwards. And it was making a little bit of racket, but I could still drive it, so we drove it home. But then I had to go buy a used rear end, a rebuilt rear end, and then me and my buddy Terry Smart Jr. I remember this day. It was after Mom passed, and we were out there. We had that truck jacked up in the front yard, and he was helping me change that rear end differential out on it. And I was having trouble getting my side to line up, and I just started crying. I just started bawling like a baby, and because it wasn't about the rear end. It was about everything I was feeling. And I'll never forget Terry Smart Jr. He's a good dude. You'll hear more about him. Terry Smart Jr. gets up and walks away and goes and cleans his hands in the shop for a little while and gives me a minute to kind of, he just gave me that dignity to, he knew what was going on. And we got that rear end change out in the truck. We go back to work. Man, we were working so hard. Well, I'm working 12-hour days. But I've also, I said autopilot, and that's what my wife called it. I went on autopilot for a while. I found no joy in anything. I stopped doing stand-up. I didn't think anything would ever be funny again. I just walked away from stand-up like it didn't even matter at that point. I did one more show after that. And one of the things my mom used to do, drove me crazy, was my mom, ever since I was young, she would not call me at work because my dad didn't like to be called at work. So my mom would always, if I was working graveyard shift, she'd call me before work. And if I was working a day shift, she'd call me after work. And I used to drive home in that little GMC pickup. She'd call me on the way home from work and tell me about pointless, inane things, or we'd argue or whatever, you know. And then the whole time I was doing comedy, right before a show, my mom would always call me. It drove me crazy. I'd be backstage trying to get ready for the show, and here's my mom calling me, telling me about my dad's bowel habits or something crazy. It has nothing to do with what's going on with me at that time. Here she comes. And then after she died, the first time I did a stand-up show, I sat backstage waiting for that phone call, and it just didn't come. And if I thought it drove me crazy before, when it didn't happen, it about broke my heart in a million pieces. And so I just walked away from stand-up. I didn't take any joy in anything at this point. And I told y'all this is going to be a two-part because there's a lot that happens in this pickup, and we're getting close to the end of the first part. But this next story I'm going to tell you ahead of time. I do not wish to insult anybody's beliefs. Everybody has their own path in this world as far as what they believe. And I'm not trying to tell you some far-fetched, crazy thing that never happened. I will tell you this story. You guys watching and listening to this will hear the most honest version of the story I can tell. When you hear it in my comedy special one day, or when you see me do it on, you know, on the stand-up stage one time, it'll be very brief and short and to the point and funny and punched up, and there'll be a lot of details omitted. But this version of the story you're about to hear, probably the most unedited that anybody will ever hear it. And I really only want to tell it once because it was a weird deal. So all this has happened. My mom's died. I told you I quit taking those pills cold turkey in the middle of all that. But I'm still in terrible pain. And I'm just barely, I'm going to work, I'm working, I'm coming home, hang out with the kids for a little bit, go to sleep, wake up, do it again tomorrow. There's no joy. There's nothing. I'm not painting. I'm not doing any woodwork. I'm not doing anything. No stand up. I'm just working and eating and sleeping. That's it. I'm losing weight. Don't care. But I'm still in all this pain. And so I go see Dr. Andy, my good old cash doctor. And I said, Dr. Andy, I can't live in this kind of pain all the time. And I've read about these steroid shots you can get in your back that help. And Dr. Andy says, well, I got a friend that does them that I'll send you to. He's over in the Woodlands. I'll tell him you're a cash patient, but they're really expensive. Well, I'm making pretty good money at the time. So I'm like, I don't care. As long as it's got me off in pills, it's going to help. So I go over to see, this guy's name is Dr. Kang. He's in the Woodlands, Texas. He's an A&M graduate. He's another reason I don't like A&M. There's a lot of reasons I don't like A&M. Every one of them's got a name. But Dr. Kang, the Asian fella, takes me in his office, checks me out, looks at all my x-rays, looks at all my imaging, my MRIs, all that stuff in my back. He says, well, I don't think you can afford these steroid shots. He never even tells me how much they cost. He just decides in his head, based on my appearance, I can't afford these shots to pay for them. He says, but I do want you to try this other medicine. It's called Neurontin, and it's a nerve medicine that's supposed to help relieve nerve pain, and we've seen great results in it in many patients. I said, all right, Dr. King, I'll give it a shot. So he calls it in my little lakeside pharmacy, and I go pick up my prescription that afternoon while I'm at work, and he says, take those pills in the evening. And so I take those pills. I take two of them, I think. And I have some of the worst nightmares I've ever had in my life that night. Didn't sleep for crap, up and down all night. Just terrible, terrible nightmares, terrible nightmares. Nightmares of my mother sitting up in the casket and screaming at me. Just the worst things you can possibly imagine are happening to me in my dreams. And I said, man, I don't know too much about this, but maybe it's just, you know, new medication. Rachel reads the stuff on the medication. She says, well, you know, what do they call those? It's like a messes with your brain. It's like an antidepressant also. It's got like some of the same stuff antidepressants get in it. What do they call it? Psychotropic. It's a psychotropic drug. And I said, huh. Kept taking it. The next night, the nightmares are worse. I don't sleep a wink at night. Get up, go to work next day. The next morning was a Wednesday morning. When I woke up, I was out of my mind. I was suicidal. I had voices in my head telling me that I was a burden to my family, and I'm terrified of death. I'm not a person that's geared that way. I knew something was wrong. I knew, if you're just like known your body is not acting the way it should, I knew my brain had betrayed me because I'm terrified of death. I'm not a person that's ever wanted to do that, no matter how bad. I am always just, man, maybe it'll get better tomorrow. I'm one of those idiots, okay? I just like, you know, I always might hit a lick. Things might get better, you know? And because it's happened so many times in my life, I've been down and desolate and just hit a lick and turn it all around, you know? That's how y'all got to know me, because during the pandemic, I was down and desolate and started making fun of people's trucks on the internet and turned it all around. isn't that ridiculous? But my brain's telling me things that I know aren't right. And I'm talking to Rachel and I'm hollering and I'm out of my mind. I'm out of my mind. And I take those pills and I run them down the disposal. And Dr. King said if I had any problems with those pills, that I should call him. I should call his office. So I call his office and I talk to his nurse and I said, I am feeling suicidal. There's something wrong. I'm having all these horrible thoughts. Da, 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 da. I really need to come in and see Dr. King. I really need to talk to Dr. King. I think it's this medicine. I'm not taking any more of it. And I wait for Dr. King to call me back, and he doesn't. He doesn't call me back at all. And I go to work out of my mind. I know that everything's not right in my head. I am completely whacked out of my gourd. I am terrified that I'm going to do something hard. I'm feeling just these horrible thoughts, and I'm seeing these horrible visions every time I close my eyes. I did not know a medicine could do this to you. Not something that's supposed to help you. That had not been my experience, you know? And I used to, right there at, where April Point South is, on 105, there's a McDonald's and a little Shell station right there on the lake. And that's where I used to eat my lunch. I used to go in there and get like a Happy Meal for kids because I didn't like to eat a lot during the day because of the heat and working outside. And I would sit in that little GMC pickup and I would listen to music and goof around on my phone and watch the lake. There was a little part where you could pull up, you could just look right on the lake, and I'd, you know, watch people gas up their boats and people having a good time. Then I'd go back to work. It was just a nice little spot. Sometimes I'd eat inside if it was a particularly hot day. I'd go in there and eat inside. And there was this black dude that worked at the McDonald's that was always giving me grief because he knew that I smoked. And he always be, what you smoking today? You know, we just have one of those kind of relationships where we kind of goof back and forth and we're always jack-jawing at each other when I came in there. And this day, Dr. King still hasn't called me back. I'm out of my mind. I'm hungry. So I go over to this little McDonald's and I walk inside. And I ordered my food, and I sit down at one of the little tables in the McDonald's. And the next table over is a little older fella with glasses and a beard. Looks like he's probably late 70s, early 80s. And he's sitting there with a newspaper. And I sit down, and I'm kind of messing around on my phone, and he starts talking to me. He said, boy, these cars are going for crazy money, ain't they? I said, man, you ain't lying about that, bud. And we get to talking, and I find out his name is Harry. And Harry spent his whole life in Detroit as a tractor mechanic and ran a junkyard. And we've got a lot in common. You know, we talk junkyards and old junk cars. And Harry had two children as well. And the one thing he kept telling me that day, he said, just always stay close to your children, because when you get old, they're going to be the only friends you have left. And make sure they always know that. And I just appreciated everything about Harry. Harry was the kind of man that I sort of thought I wanted to be one day. And I must have sat there and talked to Harry about 45 minutes while they brought my lunch. And I ate my lunch, and me and Harry talked and said, I hope I see you again. He's like, I come to this McDonald's all the time. He was in Conroe staying with his grandkids. And I walked out of that McDonald's feeling like, you know, sometimes just the right conversation with somebody can turn everything around for you. And I walked out of there feeling hopeful, even after the events of that morning where I had come from a place of such hopelessness. I walked out of there feeling hopeful and feeling like, once again, some kind of weight had been lifted off my shoulders. And right when I was leaving at McDonald's, my phone rang, and it was Dr. King's office. No, it wasn't Dr. King's office. It was a daggum pharmacy. The pharmacy called me. I said, yeah, your doctor, Dr. King, called in another prescription for you that he wants you to switch to. He doesn't bother calling back. I call his nurse, tell her I'm suicidal. He doesn't bother to call me back. So I asked the pharmacy, I said, what's his prescription? It's an antidepressant. It basically is an antidepressant. I don't remember which one. But I call Rachel. I'm like, are you kidding me? And she looks it up and she goes, well, that one's, you know, got side effects, suicidal thoughts, all the same stuff Neurontin does too. Don't take that medicine. And I was like, I'm not going to. The hell with this. And I go to work. But I feel like a weight's been lifted because of good old Harry. Me and Harry had a good time. I come home. I tell my wife all about Harry. I tell my father-in-law. My father-in-law's living with us at the time. I tell my father-in-law all about Harry. And he's like, well, I'm glad that you met that guy, somebody you could talk to and have a moment with. And I've made my decision. I'm not going to take any more of that medicine. And that's right about the time I started doing yoga for my back. And it was actually helping pretty good and kind of helping me in the morning be mobile. And it started as a joke with my kiddo. And then I really ended up getting into it, really liking it a lot. A couple days later, this part, y'all gonna think I'm nuts. A couple days later, I go into that McDonald's, and there's my buddy, black dude, don't remember his name. And he goes, "Woo, son, you was on one the other day. What were you on, bro?" I was like, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Man, you come in here, you sat down, and you talked to yourself for like 45 minutes while, and people were like staring at you and looking at you." He said, "Dog, I come over there to see if you had a Bluetooth in." I was like pretending to mop so I could look. "You didn't have no Bluetooth in, man. You just sat there, ate your hamburger, talked to everybody in that restaurant about a junkyard and all kind of stuff." And he said, "Bro, you were out of your mind, man. And, man, what did you get a hold of? Is that good?" And I was so embarrassed, I just left. And I, to this day, I can't tell you what happened to that McDonald's. You know what I mean? Like, did I hallucinate, Harry? Did my brain, my father-in-law said, he was kind of a religious man at times. And my father-in-law told me, he said, "I think it was God." He said, "I think Harry might be your guardian angel. I think the Lord put somebody in your path to slow you down because you were going through so much that day." And I was basically having a psychotic break, you know. And also I was having these images pop up into my head that I didn't know later would turn out to be true. Things that I had forgotten that happened to me as a kid. Somebody had done something really bad to me as a kid and I had forgotten it until the shock of my mother dying had traumatized me so bad I started remembering it in bits and pieces, or this Neurontin drug stirred it. I don't know, but it all started, I was seeing flashes of it in my head and I knew, I couldn't piece it together yet, but I knew it was bad. And I don't know, so my father-in-law thought it was a guardian angel. And, you know, I've read a lot, and I've read a lot of times your brain can do things, and when your body's in trouble and your brain needs to save you, and I don't think hallucination is outside of the realm of the things your brain can do, your subconscious can do to help you. And then I was also under the effects of that Neurontin I'd been taking, and I know certain medicines can cause hallucinative effects. I don't know what's happened. I don't know what happened that day. I know I don't look a gift Harry in the mouth, because Harry saved my life that day, I think, or at least put in some work. And I looked for Harry every time I went in that McDonald's, and this day I'd never seen Harry again anywhere, anytime. But I hope I do get to see him at least one more time in my life. Oh, so I hope y'all don't think I'm crazy after that, but that's when you hear me tell it on stage, it'll be much funnier. You say, "I believe in God." God made me look dumb as hell that day. And I believe in a lot of things, but I can't explain that day. All I know is something happened that got me to a better place than where I was. I'm not going to it was about a week or two after the Harry thing. Things were settling down and we're well on into 2013. My mom died right before her birthday in January. And we buried her on her birthday. And so I guess it's probably February, March. It's kind of cold outside. One night, doing bedtime story with the kids before I put them to bed. And I was reading that John Denver book that my mother gave my kids. And I think I started crying. And by this point, we had told Aubrey, or Junie, what had happened to Nanny. And I was in the kids' room, and I was tucking Junie in to the crib. And Rachel was standing in the hallway. And Junie said, "Why are you sad? Is it because your mom's dead?" Kids just say. They just say. You know what I mean? They don't know about nuance and stuff. Junie said, "Why are you sad, Daddy? Is it because your mom's dead?" And I had to try not to laugh a little bit because it's just the way she said it struck me like, "You're being silly, bro." Like, and I said, yeah, baby, I am. I'm very sad that my mom's dead. And she said, I will never forget this. She said, don't worry, Daddy. She's all around us. Nanny's everywhere. And I had to walk out of the room and catch it in my chest before it itched, you know. And I got in the hallway, and my wife was already bawling because she had heard the whole thing. And, but when I tell you that that's a thing that really turned a corner for me in dealing with grief and stuff was my kids saying that to me. I don't know what kids know or what they come here prepared with information-wise, but I can tell you I've never looked at it the same way again. That did something to me. I told you this episode's going to be two parts, and the reason for that is because there's so much that happened in this time period that I can't mine those memories all at once. I am not physically or emotionally strong enough for that. I need to give it a break in between. So next week, I think we're going to take a trip back to the early 80s, and we're going to run a paper route with my mom and her little 1971 Volkswagen Super Beetle. That's what we're going to do next week. And then I'll come back with part two of the GMC after that. But I need a break in between. This is stuff I've not spoken about much, and it was a particularly hard time. But it's also a good time. My babies are little. I'm a dad. I'm learning so much. My children are one of the great joys of my life. So it's a good time at the same time. I love you guys. Always, I thank you for sharing your Sunday with me. If we're lucky, that resin will dry by next Sunday and I can finish this axe project. If your mom's still around, give her a hug. I love mom hugs. If dad's still around, give him a hug too. And be nice to yourself. The world can beat you down. I'm not lying when I tell you that GMC is one of the best, most reliable vehicles I ever owned. When I tell you all the rest of it, you'll be blown away. But I really didn't put much money and time in that truck. I did little repairs on it as it needed. And it was one of the best, most reliable vehicles I've ever had in my life. And that's not something I ever thought at that point that I would say about a General Motors. I just wasn't into them. It wasn't my thing. But I really took a hard look at brand loyalty. Me and my cousins were getting fights about Ford and Chevy and fist fights over it. And how stupid is that? You know, and you see people on the internet, knockdown dragouts, arguing, screaming and hollering. And the thing about brand loyalty is it's just a stupid concept. It's an idiotic concept. You're being loyal to somebody that's raking you over the coals half the time. Every vehicle manufacturer has had good and bad years. I mean, if y'all haven't figured out by now, the real truth about me is that I'm a secret Mopar boy. That's why I give them so much crap. I'm a secret little Mopar boy. I don't own one, hadn't owned one in a while, but I do love some Mopar. They've all had good and bad years. They've all had good and bad styling. Chevrolet's put out some stinkers. GM's put out some stinkers. Ford has put out some stinkers. Dodge has put out some stinkers. They've all done it. Toyota has put out some stinkers. I know, you're going to come for me, but it's true. They've all had, you can go in a junkyard, you find Toyotas all day long, all right? You go to a junkyard, you find Mazdas, you find Nissan, whatever your fanboy, and you can find them in that junkyard. God bless, I tell you, you find them. They all break down, they all cost you money. The only time brand loyalty makes sense to me is I know certain people just are more comfortable working on Ford engines because that's what they've done their whole life. And some people are more comfortable working on GM engines because that's what they've done their whole life. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's perfectly acceptable brand loyalty. And I see that all the time. That doesn't bother me at all. But it's just this, oh, Chevy sucks. Ah, Ford sucks. Now, you sound like a moron. I can't have a conversation with you. I've said that before. It's just not true. It's just the empirical data lines up against anybody that says that. Ford's outsold everybody for years, but people tell you Ford ain't never made anything good. But Ford has owned the truck market for a number of years, off and on. They all are going to get you when you least need it. And if you're lucky, you find one that's a good year model, that is from a time when they were doing things right, but they all had those periods. You gotta find what problems, and they all got problems. You just gotta find out what problems you're okay with. And anytime you bring up a 4L60 transmission, everybody on the internet, oh, it's the worst transmission ever made. Worst transmission ever made. It's not. 4L60 is actually a great transmission. The reason you hear so much about 4L60s is because they put them in everything. That transmission was used more widely than just about any other electronic shift transmission in its time period. It was in everything, and they do have some failure rates. But I can tell you, both the ones I owned went well over 200,000 miles without having to be rebuilt. Now, I cratered both of those 4L60s, but I'll tell you the story about how I cratered the GMC one. When I cratered the one in Yukon, it wasn't even a big deal. It was just shifting, and the thing lost third gear, you know, or lost first gear. But, no, it lost overdrive. But you'll never, they were actually a good unit. They were a good unit. They're easy to rebuild. They're easy to work on. They're a decent unit. There's some units that are a nightmare to work on. And don't get me wrong, I'm no transmission builder. I've tried my hand at it a couple times, only to find out at my best I am mediocre and can put a 350 turbo back together without completely ruining it. But one of my best friends is a transmission builder, and we talk about this stuff all the time, and I learn as much as I can from him as often as I can. Good old David Dork. I guess that's it. I'll catch you guys next week. It's starting to warm up in the shop, and I got a lot to do today and a podcast to edit. Thank you so much for continuing to watch. Thank you for those of you downloading it, listening to it on all the different streams. We will have some sponsorship soon. We're looking at a couple offers, talk to a couple people. If you're interested in being a sponsor of the show, you have a small business, whatever, we have a huge tier of sponsorship options that you can choose from. As much as, you know, paying for me to wear your favorite hat or whatever, you know, all kinds of stuff that we want to do. So, like, small businesses kind of get their name out there or whatever, you know. So if you're interested in that, definitely contact me at jwlcomedy@gmail.com. That's my management email. Please do not send your trucks there. They just get deleted, because I'm not the first person that goes through that email. But yeah, if you're interested in sponsorship, hit us up and we'll send you the package and you can look, see if any of it's right for your needs. And if it's not, that's okay too. I don't ask anything from y'all other than you continue to watch my stuff. And I thank you so much for doing that. This has turned out to be one of the most important projects I've ever done, and I didn't know that when I started it. And I'm really looking forward to the development of it and what it becomes. At some point, it's going to become a live show, a live streaming show, where I can have guests, and we can talk about their cars and automotive knowledge. But I need to get these stories out first, because I didn't realize how important these stories were as far as relation to building my next comedy special that I'm working on. I think that covers it. I love you, and I'm JW. Sherry, baby, Sherry baby.